Filling in for George Norrie, I am Art Bell. Hi, everybody. If you want to email me, that's easy. I'm Art Bell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L, at mindspring.com, M-I-N-D-S-P-R-I-N-G.com. Art Bell at mindspring.com or Art Bell at AOL.com, but the Mindspring account's a bit larger, and you'll probably have better luck there. So Art Bell at mindspring.com. In a moment, Dr. Michio Kaku, right back. Well, all right, if you have a physics-related question for Dr. Kaku, we'll try and get to it this hour. And by the way, he's got a lot of books you might want to look into. Parallel Worlds, A Journey Through Creation, Higher Dimensions, and the Future of the Cosmos. Hyperspace, that's a big one, a scientific odyssey through parallel universes, time warps, and the 10th dimension. And so, you know, if you were interested by what, you know, teased by what you've heard tonight, then certainly further investigation in the way of going and grabbing one of those books would be in order. Doctor, do you think that policy, national or world, would be better determined by science than politicians?
Well, I think for basic things like, you know, stem cell research, global warming, I think scientists should at least present the best case for investigation, and then an ethics panel would then advise politicians. However, if it comes to making contact with extraterrestrial intelligence in outer space, I think at this point we would have to trust the military and the politicians not to blow it. And because the inclination of scientists is to publish everything and to spread the word out, just like we decoded the Spanish flu virus of 1918, which killed something like 40 million people, and made it possible for anybody, including terrorists, to monkey with the genome of the greatest killer of modern history. So I think that scientists tend to be a little bit naive when it comes to this.
Could be.
And, oh, by the way, your listeners, if they want to be part of this whole search for extraterrestrial intelligence, there's something called SETI at Home. There's so much data coming in, even from Arecibo, that they take this data, chop it up, and then they farm it out to individuals, private individuals, who download the software of SETI at Home at Berkeley. And your screensaver, even while you're asleep, your screensaver will chug and chug and actually analyze data from the Arecibo radio telescope. Now with the Allen telescope array, there's going to be so much data from 350 radio telescopes that they're going to have to call out the cavalry and ask everybody with a PC if they wouldn't mind putting on a screensaver that will chug and chug and chug even while you're asleep and analyze for signals from outer space. Now, the security issue is kind of interesting. If your screensaver does analyze this data and finds a signal from an intelligent being in outer space, chances are it was deliberately planted by the designers of the software just to test that it works. So they do want people to call in saying, yes, yes, I found signals from intelligent life, even though it was planted there.
And even though if they called in and said, I found one, and it really was the real thing, they would be, of course, told that it was a test.
That's right. Exactly. You got it.
All right. CNN the other day did an interesting survey. They found that 60-plus percentage of people surveyed, in this case Republicans, think that they want a president who is religious, a president who worships the same God they do, and that such a president would make a far better leader. Surprised?
No. I mean, it's a free country. People are definitely allowed to have opinions like this.
Oh, yes.
My only point of view is that, as a scientist, I always believe that scientific investigation presents us with the best options, and the best possible hope for, you know, cures for diseases and solutions for problems. But then the taxpayer has to look at this data and make up their own mind as to what they want to do about it.
Okay, well, that said, that of course in religion you have these, you know, these Ten Commandment things and all these precepts that dictate that even though they're not followed all the time, that evil not be done. What precepts, similar precepts, are in science ensuring that evil not be done?
Well, doctors, for example, have to take the Hippocratic Oath, and the first principle of the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm, right?
Well, that'd be doctors. But what about the guys working on, well, I don't know, nanotechnology, for example? Or
well, what motivates people is, you know, fame, government grants, possibility of tenure, and not necessarily the loftiest motivation, but it's worked very well for the last several hundred years. Scientists want to get recognition. They want to crack open codes, solve mysteries, and look at what we've gotten. We've gotten the modern industrial age, as well as hydrogen bombs, as well as designer germs, as well as all the other things that go along with it. But just remember that it's governments meddling with the pure science. They gave us the atomic bomb. It wasn't scientists themselves who said, oh, let's make an atomic bomb today. Oh, no, it was the government who jump-started it with the Manhattan Project. Same thing with designer germs. Scientists were very happy to crack the DNA code back in the 1950s, but it was governments who said, okay, you cracked the code. Now let's make some designer germs to fight the next war. So scientists left to themselves do not build atomic bombs. They don't build gas chambers. They don't build designer germs. Scientists left to themselves simply want to investigate, you know, what makes the universe tick. And a lot of them do it for very altruistic reasons. They could make a lot more money on Wall Street. But instead, they want to pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge and also for the sake of uplifting, you know, the state of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Politicians come in that they want to build atomic bombs and designer germs.
Yes, but the scientists do make it possible.
They definitely make it possible.
All right. I want to touch on the Hadron Collider. I know it's getting close now.
That's right.
And I guess we're going to get a lot of really big questions answered by this collider, right?
Well, we hope so.
Outside
Geneva, Switzerland, next year, we're counting down the months now,
right,
the biggest machine of science ever built in the history of Homo sapiens will be turned on. It's 27 kilometers in circumference. You could put the city of Geneva inside the machine. That's how big this machine is. It would wrap around the entire city of Geneva if you put Geneva inside. And it's going to recreate conditions not seen since the Big Bang.
So we'll be able to learn what the conditions were essentially a fraction of a second or a second after the Big Bang. Is that realistic?
That's right. That's the modest goal. The modest goal is we want to recreate some of the conditions that existed at the instant of creation itself. But the more ambitious goal, and this is where I come in, this is what my friends do, this is what I do for a living, is that we want to crack the biggest code of all, and that is the theory of everything. Mm-hmm. What I do for a living is I work on something called string theory. In fact, I'm the co-founder of string field theory, which
right.
is one of the main branches of string theory. And string theory, we think, is the theory that Einstein failed to find for 30 years of his life. Einstein wanted a theory of everything. He wanted an equation 1 inch long that would allow him to summarize all the physical laws of the universe and allow him to, quote, read the mind of God. That was Einstein's goal. He failed. Well, today we think we have it. The theory is so fantastic that many scientists just threw up their hands and their eyes went into the heavens contemplating the implications of this theory. String theory implies that the universe is hyperdimensional, that there could be other universes out there, and this was simply too much for the old guard. For years and years, string theory existed because scientists, you know, to the detriment of their careers, worked on the theory. But recently, it's become, you know, the raging fashion. All of a sudden, New York Times, Time Magazine, Music Magazine run feature stories on string theory, which is quite different from the way it was when I was a graduate student writing articles on string theory.
One also has to imagine the Hadron Collider will go on and the string theory will come apart like a giant ball of twine.
We hope that the universe doesn't unwind if we build the Large Hadron Collider. We hope to find sparticles. Sparticles are superparticles. They are higher octaves of the superstring. We are the lowest set of vibrations of the string.
Figures.
The string being a tiny rubber band that gives you the vibrations of electrons, protons, neutrons, and what have you. And we think that physics is reduced to nothing but harmonies of the string. Chemistry is nothing but melodies you can play on these colliding strings. The universe is a symphony of strings. And we think that the mind of God that Einstein eloquently wrote about in the last decades of his life, the mind of God, we think, is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace.
Was he speaking of a God of creation?
He called it the Old One. That is a harmony that existed at the instant of creation that then governs all physical law. He called it the Old One, God, in other words. This is not a personal God, he was very careful to say. It's the God of Spinoza. It's the God of Leibniz. It's the God of reason, logic, harmony, unification, and beauty.
Science.
That's what Einstein considered God.
Science.
And he wanted to crack the code. today we think we've done it. We have to test it. People are going to laugh at us unless we can find evidence of this theory. This theory is very difficult to test because it is a theory of the instant of creation. It's a theory of parallel universes. It's a theory of hyperdimensions, up to 11 dimensions now. And we hope to find the first clues to this theory by finding sparticles. And, well, we're taking bets right now as to whether or not the Large Hadron Collider is powerful enough to produce sparticles.
And your bet would be?
Well, I'd say 50-50. That our machine was called the Super Collider to be built outside Dallas, Texas.
And we gave up.
We're wondering how come it's a European machine? How come it's not an American machine? Well, Congress canceled our machine. The Congress gave us $1 billion back in the 90s to dig a hole for this machine. Congress canceled our machine and gave us a second $1 billion to fill up the hole. I can't think of anything more stupid than giving scientists $1 billion to dig a hole, canceling it, and giving us a second $1 billion to fill up that hole.
Isn't that what we do with most of our money, throw it in holes?
That's right. Literally. Literally, that's what we did outside Dallas, Texas. A huge hole was dug to build a machine, but then the Congress got cold feet. You know, $11 billion was too much for Congress. Now, of course, we spend $500 billion in Iraq. But $10 billion was considered too much. Well, the Europeans are not shy about this. They spent $10 billion building their machine, and it's going to go online in just a few more months now.
It is exciting. Is it possible, Professor, that we will be able to figure out what happened to antimatter? Where antimatter, it's got to be somewhere.
Yeah, that's the famous CP violation problem. It was Andrei Sakharov, the counterpart of Edward Teller, the man who built the Russian hydrogen bomb.
Yes.
It was Andrei Sakharov who asked that question, where did the antimatter go?
Mm-hmm.
And he said there was an imbalance, a slight imbalance called symmetry breaking, that existed at the instant of creation. And we are the leftovers. We are the leftovers of this slight imbalance, because matter and antimatter collide and release energy, tremendous amounts of energy.
Somewhere there's a positron, right? Somewhere.
The positron would be an anti-electron, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I was in high school, I played with positrons and went to the National Science Fair taking pictures of antimatter. But that's another story. The point here is that the instant of creation had an asymmetry. We are the leftovers of that asymmetry, otherwise we wouldn't be here. If it was purely a balance between matter and antimatter, then just like in Star Trek, there would have been a huge explosion and nothing would have been left. There would be no Earth, no planets, no stars. We are the leftover from that asymmetry. But the origin of that asymmetry, no one knows. And we hope that string theory may eventually answer that question. Why are we here? In some sense, we have no right to be here. We should have been annihilated by antimatter at the instant of creation.
But instead, antimatter disappeared.
Yeah, annihilated with matter, and we're the leftovers of that titanic collision between matter and antimatter.
But it can't really disappear, can it? So it's...
It turned to energy. If you read Dan Brown's book about the Vatican... he postulates that this secret society of anti-Catholics created an antimatter bomb to blow up the Vatican. Well, it would bankrupt the United States of America to build an antimatter bomb. We could do it, but it would bankrupt the world, basically. to create enough antimatter to do any damage. All the antimatter in the world that we've built so far can barely light up a light bulb.
So it just wouldn't be practical.
That's right. But we know it exists. And one day, if we can harvest it, it may take us to the stars, just like on Star Trek.
Or it may blow us to the stars. Is it possible that the Hadron Collider will essentially tell us where to find antimatter? And if we do find it, will we do the right thing with it, whatever that is?
Well, the Large Hadron Collider will produce copious quantities of antiprotons. And if you then hit antiprotons with positrons, uh-huh. as you mentioned before, anti-electrons, right. then you get anti-atoms. Uh-huh. And we have, in fact, made anti-atoms, not very many. You can probably count them on your hand. But we've actually made anti-hydrogen, anti-atoms. And sooner or later, we'll make anti-helium. And sooner or later, we'll have anti-chemistry. But that's, of course, far away. It takes an enormous amount of energy to create these things. But the Large Hadron Collider will create large quantities of antimatter.
And may lead us down, start us down the path.
Of understanding why the Big Bang banged. What set off the bang? What lit the fuse that created the universe? That's what we hope this Large Hadron Collider will answer. String theory right now is so mathematically difficult that we can't get a definitive yes or no from it. So we're hoping that the Large Hadron Collider will tell us why it banged. I mean, what set it off? Okay. We have our own opinions, we physicists. String theory seems to indicate that what set it off was that the universe peeled off from a parent universe, that our universe is nothing but a baby universe that peeled off from a mother universe. And that just like, budding and sprouting of plants that you have in your garden, that universes can sprout from other universes. Just like soap bubbles can break in half and create baby soap bubbles. That's probably where our universe came from.
Are you at all concerned, Professor, that it will in fact lead us not further into string theory, but whatever answers we get may lead us in another direction?
Well, my attitude is, let the cards fall where they may. Nature will dictate reality, not pencil and paper.
That's true.
We physicists can come up with all sorts of cockamamie ideas, but ultimately nature has to verify the theory. However, that said, string theory is the only theory that allows us to combine Einstein's theory of gravity mm-hmm. with the quantum theory, the quantum theory being basically atomic physics. And it's the only theory, it's the only game in town that allows us to unify gravity with the nuclear force.
Even that said, are you a bit on pins and needles, this beginning to get so close?
Yeah, we're taking bets. It was supposed to be turned on this year, but there was a problem with the magnets, so it got delayed a few months. So the christening won't take place for a few more months. And when it's turned on, we're very anxious to find what new particles or what new physics could come out. Physics has been pretty much at a standstill for the last 30 years, high-energy physics, because we've had no new machine in 30 years. This is our first big machine.
Truly exciting, then.
Truly exciting, right? And some people, of course, ask, is it dangerous? And the answer is not really. It's underground for the most part. It does not have enough energy to open up a hole in space, so don't worry that a black hole is going to emerge out of Geneva, Switzerland. Cosmic rays from outer space have more energy than...
No big bangs.
And there'll be no big bangs coming out of Geneva, Switzerland, right?
All right. Professor, hold it right there. A lot of people want to talk on the phone. We'll get to that coming up in a moment. I'm Art Bell. For George Norrie on this Friday night, Saturday morning, headlines, if I were to write them, would be Dr. Michio Kaku gets excited about SETI. And then below that, and suggests any signal received not be made public. Those would be the headlines in a moment. We'll get to all of you. It certainly is a rush to be on radio again and be able to share some time with you, particularly with somebody the caliber of Dr. Michio Kaku. All right, Doctor, if you're ready, we're going to...
Okay.
Well, here we go. Charles in Kauai, Hawaii, you're on with Dr. Kaku. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Kaku. I'd like you to see if you could visualize a fusion confinement vessel and tell me if you think it'll work or not. Mm-hmm. So imagine a row of hoops in a wasp waist configuration with a divergent and convergent section, so they narrow towards the middle of it. And these hoops are independently powered in the centralmost one has the heaviest current, so it's the highest magnetic field. And as you go along it, actually, you impose the electric field along it. So what you have a combination of electric and magnetic fields, so the plasma is repelled from the outer edges electrically, but it can't get anywhere in the center because of the magnetic field squeezing it tightly. Do you think that would work?
Okay, let's see. You have a bunch of hoops. Each hoop, of course, would be an electromagnet creating a magnetic field.
Yes.
What is the overall configuration of these hoops? That's the key. These hoops make what kind of envelope, as we say?
A wasp waist magnetic field. It's like a linear. It's like a solenoid, only it's more intensely pinched in the center, wasp waist wise.
Like an hourglass.
Yes.
Like an hourglass. Well, okay. The problem there is that leakage is the main problem, and it would probably leak out of the top and the bottom.
That's why the electric field's there.
See, the tokamak design, which is the design that came out of Russia, takes your hourglass, makes it into a cylinder, and then wraps it into a donut so that when it leaks out of one end, it leaks into itself. It's self-leaking.
I think I've heard of a polygon of solenoids, too, that did that around in a racetrack.
Yeah, well, believe me, a lot of designs were tried. Even the threads of a baseball, believe it or not, in the 60s, people actually tried to make a plasma machine out of the threads of a baseball, okay?
Yeah, that makes some sense, though.
And then
so I guess the conclusion is
find the plasma inside. Many, many designs have been tried. The problem is leakage. Even if you have electric fields on the top and the bottom of the hourglass, okay, you're going to get leakage coming out because of the fact that the plasma itself has its own magnetic field. That's the problem. It's like, you know, squeezing a balloon, except the air inside the balloon itself has magnetic properties and goes every which way when you try to squeeze it.
And then how do the French or the Europeans imagine they're going to tackle this?
Okay, they also take a tokamak design, that is a donut. So when gas leaks out one end of the donut, it basically leaks into itself. It goes in a circle. So there is leakage in the ITER, but it leaks into itself, and that minimizes the overall leakage.
Got it.
So it's the Soviet design. They came out with it first. That's why it's called the tokamak. But it is a design of choice. It is a design that every physicist uses when we talk about hot fusion.
Okay. All right. John in rain-starved Atlanta, you're on with Professor Kaku.
Doctor, this is John in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was a young man going to Georgia Tech, I dreamed up ideas to try to break hydrogen out of water. Tell me what your idea is. Will that ever be done, or is science working on that? It seems like it'd solve our problems for energy forever.
Well, this is the fuel cell. You take ordinary water, you apply electric current to it, and that breaks up H2O into H and O. And then when the H and O combine again inside a car, you create waste water, but you release energy in the process. It's called electrolysis. And Honda is even marketing a fuel cell car now. It's being advertised on television, for God's sake. So we know that fuel cells work. In outer space, NASA pioneered the use of these fuel cells, extracting energy from combining hydrogen with oxygen. And we know that they work, except they're very expensive. That's why we don't have fuel cell cars right now. But as I see it, the marketplace will make oil very expensive and will reduce the cost of fuel cells. And at some point, the two curves will cross. And when that crossing takes place, then there'll be a mad rush to create solar hydrogen cars.
Okay, Professor, just out of idle curiosity, at how many dollars per gallon do you imagine the intersection of those lines?
Okay, well, take a look at Europe. People complain about $3 a gallon in the United States. You go to Europe and they say, oh, my God, that's so cheap. I mean, how come you guys have such free energy in America?
Right? Yes. Yeah, well, most of that's taxation in Europe, of course.
And also, yeah, a lot of it is taxation. And, there are other reasons, that, you know, they don't have the supply lines, blah, blah, blah. But the point is that the crossing of these curves could take place within, let's say, 15 years. 10, 15, 20 years, we don't know for sure. It depends on how efficient solar cells come. Solar cells right now are several times more expensive than oil-fired or coal-fired plants,
sure.
several times more expensive.
Sure.
But with the two curves gradually converging, every year solar cells become more efficient. Every year this hydrogen technology gets more advanced. I see a crossing taking place.
Right. Again, though, let me try and rephrase it. At that crossing point, what would you imagine the cost per barrel of oil to be?
Okay, in U.S. dollars right now, okay,
yes.
I would imagine it would have to hit, let's say, maybe $7 or $8 a gallon right now, okay?
Oh, we're back to the gallon. Okay, $7 or $8 a gallon in the U.S.
In the U.S. before it becomes economical to go to solar hydrogen. In other words, it's not economical at all.
Right, but between here and there, there's a lot of pain.
There's going to be a lot of pain, right?
Yeah.
But again, every year, solar hydrogen becomes more efficient, more advanced, and with mass production tax credits, you could jumpstart this technology, just the way nuclear was jumpstarted by the Pentagon.
Sure.
Nuclear energy would not be economical unless the taxpayer had funded research in nuclear energy back in the 50s.
Here's another taxpayer. Harry in Texas, you're on with Dr. Kaku.
Thank you. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I just have a craving for books. And let me run a scenario by you. I'd like your comments on it. To me, the question of is there life out there is not a matter of logistics or finding luck or whatever. It's more a matter of timing. Since we all originated apparently from a Big Bang, all the ingredients are there elsewhere. It's a matter of timing. When does it evolve into something that can sustain life? So what I think about is, well, what is the universe for? What is it doing? What is it trying to accomplish? And it seems to always fall back to motion, vibration, frequency. Every solar system is a giant armature. Every galaxy a giant armature. And so
sounds a lot like string theory to me.
Yeah, so here's my question. I play around with sound waves because I can see them. And I play guitar. And it seems to me that long sound waves consume short sound waves. Is that a true statement?
Long waves do what with short waves?
Consume short. In other words, if you play a harmonic with a long short or a long sound wave and a harmonic of a short sound wave, a higher pitch note, the lower pitch note sustains itself off of the higher pitch note, but the higher pitch note goes away quicker. You follow what I'm saying?
Waves don't necessarily consume other waves. Waves add. That's called superposition.
Okay.
And when they add, they can then appear as if they're consuming another wave. But waves basically, you know, add on top of each other. I play the trumpet and the guitar, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And when I blow notes or twang a guitar, notes may appear to gobble up other notes, but they're actually superimposed upon each other. And you get, you know, what are called harmonics when you play guitar.
Right,
but string theory is precisely based on harmonics. String theory says that, you know, a proton and electron are with tiny little rubber bands, and these rubber bands vibrate. And when they vibrate at different frequencies in different ways, they turn into different particles. So how many different frequencies can you put on a violin string or a rubber band? The answer is infinite, right? That's why we have an infinite number of particles. And when these two particles collide, then these two vibrations can, in fact, consume each other, as you say, to give you a third vibration. And that's what we call chemistry.
I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind, I know the time is short. When I put a tuning fork into water, the sound waves go outward. But just before the tuning fork completely dies vibrations, it seems to attract sound waves back to it and give one last tone after it is dead. And the same is true with a harmonic on a guitar. You can hit a harmonic on a guitar, and it'll play through, and it deadens, and then quickly it comes back as if it's retracting. Now, that could that be conceived as the long waves stretching the short waves until they can no longer stretch, and then it snaps back, so to speak?
I'm not sure. I've never seen that effect. I've played with musical instruments all my life. Maybe you can email me. My website is mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and my email address is on. And maybe you can email me this effect, and I can then duplicate it. But right now, it's kind of hard for me to visualize that.
Okay. All right. Susie in Orange, California, Orange County, you're on with Dr. Kaku.
Oh, hi. Gosh, I can't believe I got on the radio. Real quickly, I just was curious, why haven't the utilities, any utility that I've heard of anywhere, why aren't they, like, putting solar panels on every Southern Exposure building that they can get their hands on, that people will let them, rather than waiting for the individual homeowner to pay, you know, like $30,000, you know, to do it themselves? It just seems like they're not really serious about global warming. If a utility can buy solar panels, I'm sure, for, you know, but when you're buying a million of them, you're going to get them a lot cheaper than when you're going to buy 30. So I don't understand why they expect, or they, you know, they're trying to urge with a very minimal federal tax credit, and you get some money back. Well, you can get free energy, but that doesn't, it's so expensive for the homeowner to do it. I don't know why the utilities aren't doing it.
Well, you're right that if you mass produce these things and you buy them in bulk, you can get it a lot cheaper. And, for example, some utilities are going into wind power because they see the benefits of wind parks. And in Europe, you know, you see wind parks everywhere you go in Europe. However, solar is still a little bit on the expensive side. Homeowners who do this, of course, are multimillionaires. They're Hollywood celebrities who can afford to put solar panels on their house. It's not something for the average person unless you know what you're doing. And utilities look at the economics. The bottom line is a dollar. And they see that solar is still, you know, more expensive, even with mass production. My attitude is we should jumpstart the technology. You know, the federal government should subsidize research in this thing. There should be tax credits. Mass production of these things will reduce the cost. And then we can bring down the cost where it is competitive, where you don't have to be a Hollywood millionaire to put one of these things on your rooftop. But right now, it is still a little bit on the expensive side. And the two curves have not yet met yet.
But they are closing.
They're closing very fast, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. David in Mesa, Arizona. Good morning. You're on with Dr. Kaku.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Sure.
Wow, what a privilege to speak with you and Dr. Kaku. And my gosh, what a sensationally educational show. I've been so greatly impressed by, gosh, each and every one of your topics that you and Dr. Kaku have been discussing, including the global energy problem we're all faced with. Now, I wrote a book about power beaming solar energy space via high-intensity microwaves to Earth.
It's
called Sunstroke.
Right, David Kagan.
Oh, Mr. Bell, what a
good memory.
Pleasure. Look, super congratulations for Asia.
Thank you. Anyway, your question?
Yes, sir, I do have a question for the esteemed Professor Cox.
And that is?
This is indeed a grand honor for me, sir. Now, I've followed your scientific works, including parallel universes of string theory, for many years. Now, regarding the solar hydrogen mix you spoke about, would you include power beaming solar energy to Earth via microwaves as presently being proposed by the U.S. Pentagon, even if it means utilizing it as a space-based weapons?
Oh, I think that'll perhaps change the answer.
Okay. Well, I'm in favor of looking at all different kinds of power alternatives into the coming decades because of the threat of global warming, even though I have my doubts about commercial nuclear energy. Looking at outer space, cost has always been a big problem. Recently, the Pentagon did come out with a report that I've looked at saying that perhaps power can be beamed from outer space to the troops, where price is not as essential. Just getting energy to them at all would be a great thing. So they've looked at the question of beaming power from outer space. I've looked at it. And, again, there are many logistical problems. You know, stationary satellites are 22,000 miles away, and there's a lot of attenuation of the energy from 22,000 miles away. If a satellite is simply overhead, then they go around the Earth every 90 minutes, in which case you'd have to have hundreds of these things orbiting at any given point. And, if you know, then aiming is a problem. If you miss, you may, you know, scorch a certain area of the Earth. But, you know, these are technical problems. And in principle, as you point out, they can be solved, except the price has to come down, okay? Now, on the other hand, the Pentagon also looks at the other possibility of using these things as weapons. In outer space, we forget that there are no wall sockets in outer space. power is a premium in outer space. And so what do you do for energy? You may build these gigantic solar panels, convert the energy to microwaves, and then knock out other satellites with them. My attitude is very simple. As the Chinese say, never pick up a rock only to drop it on your own feet. Who is the most vulnerable to killer satellite warfare in outer space?
We are.
Who has the most satellites? Who has the most communication networks? Is most vulnerable if somebody decides to blow up satellites in outer space?
That would be us.
It's us, hands down. And if we open up, the militarization of space, it's like putting sand in our own eyes. If you're going to be in a fight, you don't want to pick up a bunch of sand and put it in your own eyeball, right? That's a stupid thing to do. So I would say that we don't get into killer satellite warfare, even though the Chinese, of course, recently, a few months ago, blew up one of their satellites. I don't think we should get into this because we have the most to lose in the opening shots of a war. Gunfighters always throw sand in the other guy's eyeball, right?
Well, of course, yes. You
know, we shouldn't be blowing up satellites because we're the most vulnerable. We could be blinded so easily because our satellites are unshielded, totally unshielded. We don't shield our satellites in outer space. That's why solar flares, for example, and sunspot cycles can definitely injure our communication.
No, but I bet we've got a lot of very secret backup satellites just sitting there in the blackness of space, black themselves, waiting for the eventuality you just discussed.
Yeah, these are called dark satellites. I wouldn't put it past the Pentagon to have launched satellites with the capability of doing that. However, the Pentagon has not ever carried out such a test of a what is called ASAT, or anti-satellite device, while the Chinese have. And they've got roundly condemned by everybody, created an enormous amount of space debris and out of space by blowing up a satellite. You know, we track 10,000 pieces of debris, screwdrivers, pieces of old satellite, booster rockets, screwdrivers and tools. We track 10,000 pieces of debris orbiting the Earth left over from the space program. The Chinese simply polluted a lot more debris when they smashed one of their satellites. You can imagine what's going to happen if there's a killer satellite war in outer space. There'll be hundreds of thousands of pieces of debris in outer space. That's the end of the space program. Satellites will not, people will not be able to go through this belt of junk.
Man, you can't put up signs, adopt a geosynchronous orbit.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, Professor, as always, it has been such a pleasure being on the air with you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, and we will definitely do it again one day. You're just
okay.
Really fun to talk to. Take
okay,
care.
Okay, anytime.
Good night, Professor.
Good night.
That's it, folks. Professor Michio Kaku from the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.